tomorrow. As recorded before a live audience in Pasadena, California, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
What if someone walked along Park Avenue in New York, had a sign on his back, New York shall one day never again be inhabited? How long would he last? Maybe in New York a little longer than in L.A., even, I don't know, but he wouldn't last long in most big cities. Now, you know, there's streets where he would be safe. Hollywood and Vine, he'd make it there okay. Wouldn't be, I don't think, bothered. There are people who do that. They have signs on their backs, so they go around telling people to flee from the wrath to come. But he would be taken just about that seriously. Jesus were to come back to this earth today and preach a sermon right out of Luke 21, people would think he's weird. Why is he trying to scare people by talking about the potential of a nuclear bomb war? Why is he talking about there shall be great earthquakes? We don't have great earthquakes in diverse places, and famine. Now, if we're having famines, and are famines tending to increase today? Is it just cyclical in nature? Is it just that, well, there's sunspot activity, and every 20 years you tend to have a dry cycle, and is that all there is to it? Or don't you see, as you look into the picture of food versus population, of the utter inability of the human population to be fed by existing agricultural production? As you look at the grain failures in the Soviet Union and the grain sales by the United States and by Canada and Australia and to some extent Argentina, the four major grain producers, to other nations which cannot produce enough for themselves, India, Southeast Asia, the Soviet Union, one of the principal users of grain, especially from the United States and Canada. Are we having famine? Was it a good guess? Is it the most successful possible badge you could ever place on the lapel of a would-be prophet to say if you stand up and claim there are going to be wars and natural disasters, you can't go wrong? Why? Well, because we've always had wars and we've always had natural disasters, and obviously we're going to continue to have natural disasters. The island down there in the Caribbean is probably going to blow its back one of these days. We'll probably have some great big volcanoes up in Iceland. Probably be an earthquake again down in Peru. Don't get excited about it. So what if the city is wiped out here and there? So what if Managua doesn't look like it used to? That doesn't really fulfill prophecy. That was happening before Jesus made the prophecy, people could argue. And it'll be happening long after the Christian religion has gone and has been replaced by a Big Brother society under the communist hammer and sickle. Some people might argue that. I believe that Jesus meant exactly what he said. And I believe that the signs that he said for us to watch, which would grow in intensity, which would overlap wars and rumors of wars, accompanied by great earthquakes in diverse places, famines, pestilences, that is, disease epidemics, and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. Now, apparently that's one thing that hasn't really been happening, and I don't say that UFOs are fulfilling that prophecy. Maybe some people are afraid by some things they see in the heavens. I know that during the last time, what was the name of this one? They named it after the Russian who discovered it. The comet that was on its way during one Rose Bowl game, were walking down here toward the Rose Bowl on the way back up, and here are these kids out there, and they're giving me these little pamphlets that tell me to flee from the wrath to come. They knew that this comet was going to strike the earth. We're all going to be dead by a certain day. But Jesus did say in Matthew 24, there would be wars and rumors of wars, drought, famine, and pestilence. Both Matthew 24 and Luke 21 are the exact interpretation of those seals of the sixth chapter of the book of Revelation that talk about false religions, religious confusion, eventual religious persecution to the point of martyrdom, even under the auspices of some state government. I don't mean an individual state in our country. I mean various federal or various national governments, and also that there would be drought, famine, and disease epidemics. Now, all of these are called, in Matthew 24, the Great Tribulation, a time of world trouble. He said in verse 21, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved." But he said, "For the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." I know that it's easy to sleep atop a bomb. I've been there. You can get quite comfortable. It's a little cold, maybe, but with one of these great big flight deck jackets, it can be real comfortable atop a bomb. And I know that it's pretty easy to take for granted living in a nuclear-armed world with the capability of the destruction of 50 worlds like ours. It's a world most of you have grown up in. It's a world you're acquainted with. It's the only one you've got. So what's the reason to get excited? We've heard the words so often, it's like the old story of Wolf, Wolf. But really, has there ever been a weapon from the time of a knife, a spear, a cutlass, the Gatling gun, the machine gun, a modern aircraft or a submarine, even to the atomic bomb, which has not been used? Have the scientists, have the military geniuses in their inventiveness and their ingenuity of looking for greater and ever more effective and more accurate methods of dispensing with human flesh ever failed to use weapons systems that they have designed? Will there come a time when, as the United States continues to pour super sophisticated weaponry into the Middle East, which has made that the most heavily militarized region of the entirety of the earth today, and it seems to be strange because it's at the same time the most volatile political area, one of the most unstable religious areas, one of the most absolutely important economic areas because it's the very heart and the core of the energy resource supplies for the rest of all the major world nations, West and East, Japan, all of Europe, the United States. We are now utterly dependent upon Middle Eastern oil. The fossil fuels that come from beneath the sands of those desert civilizations over there, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Abu Dhabi, of Dubai, of Bahrain, of course of Iran, they have more limited reserves, but we're still getting oil from there, and they're a member of OPEC, and though they're not Arab, they nevertheless are Muslim by religion. You need to understand then that the Middle East is the focal point a but that can go wrong in the world, and yet the United States, in order to achieve a certain amount of equilibrium between various vengeful neighbors, is willing to let a little bit at a time go to people who hate one another across various national borders. So we're supplying the Shah of Iran, who has dreams of a new Persian Empire, with modern weapons that our own armed forces aren't getting in quantities yet. Did you see that television special? Of how here was a speech made by one of the heads of Grumman with his gleaming F-14 in the background, and the ambassador from Iran was there to take over what he calls this beautiful airplane. You better believe it's beautiful. For what is it, about $8 or more million a copy? You bet it's beautiful. Maybe it's more than that. I forget. I don't know how they can build them that cheaply anymore. But they had delivered wings of those things over there. And then they were talking to some of the U.S. Air Force instructors of how they're trying to bridge a gap of thousands of years from people who come from the villages whose lives have remained virtually unchanged for thousands of years, who have no technical background. Not that they have not been educated, and not that they cannot come to the United States, to our universities where many Iranian students are, and that they cannot learn, of course, and to bridge that gap fairly quickly. But the point was, with no background in technology, hardly any of these men had ever owned or driven a car. They've never had motorcycles or other machinery to work upon, and they're taken from a village background, drilled through the army, taken into cadets, and bang, they're looking inside the systems of an F-14. And the instructors were telling how difficult it was to bridge the gap from village barefoot life to a fighter pilot controlling something that can go to 98,000 feet in 3.5 minutes with all those systems. But they're willing to do it because that's what makes the world go around. You see, we need the money. But more than that, we need the Shah of Iran to be happy. Because if the Shah of Iran's not happy, well, he might cut off some of his oil. And we want to be able to drive our Mazdas and Subarus and Toyotas, all these cars made in Detroit, around our cities and around our streets. And we want to be able to drive our Mercedes and all these other automobiles by those people we blasted halfway to bits in World War II and said they would never rise again. And in order to drive those automobiles, we've got to get the oil that is imported from nations who wish that the Israelis would disappear off the face of the earth, who sound a lot in some cases, when you listen to some of them at least, like Muammar Gaddafi, which I think sometimes is synonymous with imbecile, in a nation over there in North Africa who is directly funding some of the international terrorist groups and is proud to admit that he is doing so, who wages war on innocent women and children who are merely harmless tourists aboard international air carriers. But you begin to really wonder. The United States is the biggest arms trafficker in the world, and yet we have more groups that are opposed to war. And during Vietnam, when they really had a crucible to put on their shoulder and march on Washington with, of course, our cities were falling apart with various urban disturbances and riots. The battlefield was as much on the campus as it was in Vietnam. But now we are pouring these arms into nation after nation around the world, and most especially into the direction of the Middle East. Jesus talks about a world ruling government. And almost no one seems to understand that is what his message was all about. And it centers in its interest around the Middle East because that happens to be the capital. That happens to be the place of God's attention. I'm going to turn to the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel because that is a prophecy at the termination of one of the longest prophecies in all of the Bible that again talks about the time of the end. At the time of the end, it says in verse 40, shall the king of the south push at him. Now, traditionally, all Bible scholars who go to various theological seminaries will learn, if they study anything at all about eschatology or prophecy, that this king of the south was a line, really, of rulers in the nation of Egypt called Ptolemies, of which there were many, just like there were many Caesars, of which the Russian equivalent is Tsar, and just like there were many of the Seleucidae, or the Seleucids, in the area of Syria, which is now partly Turkey as well as Syria, and that was the king of the north. And they will learn this by studying some of the biblical reference works. And that hapless Jerusalem and the nation that is now called Israel, or formerly Palestine, lay right in the path of these two war-making forces, the king of the north and the king of the south. But this is a modern prophecy. It doesn't say at the time of the Middle Ages, or at the time that Jesus walked the earth, but at the time of the end. Now, Jesus talked about a time when, and then shall the end come. And this talks of the time of the end. There are many biblical prophecies that describe what is the time of the end. And that merely means the time when the potential for the annihilation of humankind would be upon us. And that time is here right now. It says the king of the south shall push at him. Now, whether or not that is a direct military attack would be perhaps arguable. It doesn't seem to say that. It seems to imply something other than that. It is not an armed attack because of the description in the verses. The king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north, action, reaction, shall come against him like a whirlwind. So it's a very quick, lightning-like attack that is apparently coming from some area to the north of what used to be Palestine. And, of course, it uses old biblical words such as chariots, horsemen, and many ships. But perhaps you could liken that to planes and tanks and ships of today, because we would understand in this language that it means modern military weapons. And he shall enter into the countries, many nations involved, and shall overflow, that is, not stop at any one border, but continually, like an avalanche, taking over nation after nation, and pass over. He, this king of the north, shall enter also into the glorious land. Notice the difference in the language. Many countries shall be overthrown. He shall enter into the countries, overflow and pass over. But when it comes to Palestine, it just says he shall enter also into the glorious land. For many years, I've wondered whether or not, in the event of the imminent destruction of the nation of Israel, and for a time, if you will recall, in the gamble that Sadat made, and I talked to him about that when I interviewed him on the program. In 1973, when, for all practical purposes, the Egyptian government decided to wage a war to recapture shattered Egyptian pride. They really were laboring under the idea of the worldwide public opinion that the nation of Israel was invincible. The Bar-Lev line, which I have seen with my own eyes, was a modern Maginot or Siegfried line, and if anything, far better. You have to understand that here were great, huge, steep sand dunes with, of course, rock underneath on each side of the Suez Canal. But on the eastern side of the Suez Canal, where the Israelis were, they had tunneled completely underneath. And it's 120 miles long. And they had built fortifications with just gun snouts sticking out And behind all of this, subterranean underneath, links along the entire length of it, were corridors big enough to drive jeeps and trucks and so on and to house personnel in, and opening to the rear behind these precipitous bluffs. The Barlev line must have cost an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of labor and work, but apparently, at nighttime when the Egyptians crossed over, they managed to breach just a portion of it, and through hydraulic action of getting very powerful pumps aboard barges, they actually pumped water out of the Suez Canal and began to flood the areas of that Barlev line, and so drove the Israelis back and managed to get an army completely across, and to begin through bulldozers and so on. As you know, they actually filled in the area instead of building a pontoon bridge that could be destroyed, and they had broached the Barlev line. And so it looked like for several days in the first part of the 1973 Yom Kippur War that Israel was, in fact, going to be overwhelmed, that she might have to sue for peace, that the Israelis might be driven back even perhaps beyond the pre-67 war borders. No one could know. But they were catching it in the air and on the ground. This time there was no interdiction of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. This time the Egyptians caught the Israelis by surprise on the holiest of the Jewish holy days, Yom Kippur. If you read what the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations said in some very profound speeches he made as a result of the Israeli attack at Entebbe to recapture the Jewish citizens aboard the captured Airbus, and if you read the statement on the overleaf of that book of what a now deceased Israeli Air Force pilot once said, you will know that at least twice in that book is a profound statement made that the Israelis will never again silently, like sheep, be herded into the death chambers. That before, listen to this and think what it means, before they would ever do that again, they said, we will, like Solomon, pull down the temple of humanity. President Nixon is a man very much out of it today. But President Nixon happened to have been the man who had to make the final decision which sent us into the energy crisis, because he knew that the Israelis very likely had the atomic bomb. And he knew that before they would see Tel Aviv and Haifa and Jerusalem blasted, they would pull down the temple of humanity. They would use the atomic bombs at their disposal on Cairo and Damascus, and if they had, there was no telling what would have happened in the Middle East. The world could have been plunged into the midst of a nuclear bomb war in 1973. And people high enough in that nation over there have implied, and that's what that statement means. You studied the idea of Solomon, of how he himself died, blinded, almost utterly helpless, beset upon by his enemies, chained to the pillars of the temple. And you see what it means when a nation, and you can only understand it if you can read, sympathize, perhaps even empathize with what those people have been through. There are people in this world who would prefer to see all of humanity go down with them than to allow any nation to impose upon them a policy of genocide. Because they're saying to themselves, if we die, everybody dies. And we live in the kind of a world where that is just possible. It was then that our government in Washington made a decision to supply the Israelis with whatever outpouring, at whatever rate, of conventional weapons they needed. And believe me, if every Israeli pilot, I sincerely think this is the truth, had been shot from the skies, I have no doubt but that American pilots would have been there to take their place. That's just how committed Washington was. And it was because of the transshipment of American military supplies from bases in Europe and in NATO that some of the European nations also came in for the Arab oil embargo. Otherwise, Holland, West Germany, Belgium, France would have never felt the wrath of the combined nations of OPEC when the Arabs, for the first time in all of history, decided to act multilaterally, decided to get together, and decided to cut off the supply of oil to the free world. We were plunged into an energy crisis as a direct result of people high in government realizing we had to run the risk, no matter what the consequences, of pouring out whatever amount of conventional weapons to the emptying of the arsenals in our own country. to prevent the Israeli nation from going under. Because before it would go under, they would pull the temple of humanity down with all the rest of us. I think we need to realize the day in which we live. I think we need to realize there are descriptions in biblical passages which are mind-boggling. In the 6th chapter of Revelation, the 8th and 9th chapters of Revelation, descriptions of great plagues where vast segments of all of the earth are utterly rendered useless, polluted, turned to blood. Disease epidemics taking the lives of millions and hundreds of millions. Warfare which looks to be described like smoke issuing out of a bottomless pit. Men running around virtually screaming for death. People dying, becoming insane with what they see in the sight of their eyes. There are biblical chapter after chapter in Revelation, as well as many of the major prophecies in the Bible, that describe a time that is called the Day of the Lord. It even says, woe be unto you that desire the day of the Lord. It is a day of gloominess, of darkness, of thick blackness upon the mountains, and a day of the sound of a mighty host, the day of the sound of warfare. If you hear a summer thunderstorm, the rumble and the shake of thunder from far away, the crash and the flash of lightning, maybe you can get some idea of what it sounds like to hear a battle being waged 20 or 30 miles away from you. With that rumble of big guns, like they heard all along in Europe for the entirety of World War I, and like we heard over much of the world, all over Europe and Asia and the South Pacific in World War II. The Day of the Lord is described in passage after passage in the Bible as the time when vast segments of all of the human race are going to perish. Now, we live in a time, we can say, wolf, wolf. We don't want anyone to run out of the auditorium screaming. But we live in a time where the capacity for the destruction of the human race is with us. And we are now seeing that the policies that the United States government has followed, which have had practically everything to do with our employment picture, our taxation picture, the way we live our lives, our balance of payments, our GNP, everything very delicately, very finely tuned to our annual budgets that are adopted in Washington, and of the policies of each new administration in Washington, where we can blame one administration or the other for a recession or for stagflation, where we had stagnation in industry and business, which was recession in business, and runaway inflation at the same time as a result, partially, at least it was speeded up by the energy crisis when it hit in the winter of 73 and early 74. Some economists now say that we're heading out of it. Others say, look out for mid-1977, it's going to be a reaction. But I say that it has not so much to do with that as it has to do with what happens in the Middle East. It's a strange world when a farmer in Kansas can find his business virtually obliterated because of the whimsical vagaries of an Arab in Saudi Arabia. But that is the day in which we live, where Arabs who decide arbitrarily to either jack the prices out of sight or to cut off the flow of the oil can have a tremendous impact upon a society which is hooked to the flow of fossil fuels, where pesticides and herbicides, artificial fertilizers, even pills that you use which have various artificial elements in them, clothing that you wear, such as the Orlons, Dacrons, Nylons, and so on, are petrochemicals, all oil-based. The pocket comb in your pocket, the rims around your glasses, the vinyl on the top of your car, the steering wheel in the automobile, the many building materials we use, the coverings on our furniture, oftentimes even material for shoes and men's belts, comes out of wells deep beneath the surface of the sands of Saudi Arabia. Our entire society, to the tune of the oil that drives our engines, whether aloft in great vast airplanes like the 747s or the bunker fuel in ships that carry the goods of nations across the sea lanes, or the gasoline that powers your little economy car, are more and more dependent upon Arab oil. Now, here is one of the most important prophecies of all the Bible that zeroes in on several important things: the time of the end, the Middle East, gold and silver, the precious things of Egypt, Ethiopia, and the Libyans, and at the last part of it, tidings out of the north and out of the east. Now, we're learning today, and I have a lot of statistics here that I could give you, that the Soviet Union has not only been, under the cover of SALT talks,
and of detente, building up not just parity, not just equilibrium in strategic missile capability, but has been building superiority. They have, on the one hand, so improved their civil defense that their populations are apparently 90% protected, and ours are perhaps 60% or less protected. At the very same time, the Soviet Union has launched on a massive program to become the world's greatest colonial empire. You realize, of course, that following World War II, nothing could be more unpopular than for one of the former colonial empires to maintain a government, a protectorate, a member of their commonwealth, or some separate government they would have called a puppet, such as the nations of formerly the Netherlands, almost dismantled by the end of World War II. The Dutch East Indies, remember, were in the hands of the Netherlands, as Dutch Guiana was. You remember the British that had colonies all around the world, that virtually bottled up the traffic of the sea lanes of the world through the Straits of Malacca, Hong Kong, Singapore. They had the periphery around China completely bottled up, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the area just south of Saudi Arabian Peninsula, in the big, beautiful base at Trincomalee, Colombo, Ceylon. They had the southern approaches to the Red Sea, Aden, that was in their hands with a British naval base. They controlled the Suez. The Sudan was called the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. Egypt was under British control with British troops there. Gibraltar, the western approaches to the Mediterranean, firmly in British hands. Cyprus, Malta, Crete, British again. Britain itself, offshore Europe, had for centuries survived because she was like a lion lying in a gate that controlled the shipping lane, that could be completely unfettered and free from all the wars that ravaged Europe, and could have the power to build up her empire through what? Through the maintenance from the days of Anson, Frobisher, and Drake, when men of iron went down to sea in ships of wood by the largest navy the world had ever seen. And America would not be, America would not exist as a nation today if it had not been for British involvement in a gigantic war in Europe at the very precise time that the United States of America was born, and later on in the War of 1812, when once again we experienced a war with our parents over there, with our mother country, you could call it, I guess, from which most of the colonists came in Britain. It was the maintenance of vast numbers of hundreds of British men of war that accompanied the British East Indiamen and the merchants that came to this country and to Canada and eventually to Australia and the colonies around the world of the Far East, the Middle East, that made Britain a great colonial empire. The Portuguese, with colonies around the world, one of the very first persons to ever circumnavigate the globe was a Portuguese sailor. The Dutch, like Henry Hudson, who discovered Hudson's Bay, and the British. These were the colonial powers. It wasn't until after World War II that they began to be dismantled under the pressure of world public opinion sponsored by communist propaganda. The word imperialism, expansionism, aggression.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Good News magazine. In addition to his many speaking engagements, Garner Ted Armstrong also serves as editor of Good News magazine. This full-color monthly publication underscores the importance of biblical understanding in modern 20th century living. The Good News magazine. Your subscription is free of charge. There is no cost or obligation. The Good News. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.